Now Burnham and Millett made final arrangements for Burnham's own great day, the grand closing ceremony of October 30th that would recognize once and for all that Burnham really had done it, and that his work was now complete, that for once there was nothing left to do. At this point, Burnham believed, nothing could tarnish the fair's triumph or his own place in architectural history. Frank Millett expected the closing ceremony to attract even more people than the fair's Chicago day. While Millett did his planning, many of the other men who had helped Burnham construct the fair began the return to ordinary life, among them 10,000 construction workers. They left the fair's employ and returned to a world without jobs, already crowded with unemployed men. Once the fair closed, many thousands more would join them on Chicago's streets. The threat of violence was as palpable as the deepening cold of autumn. Mayor Harrison was sympathetic and did what he could. He hired thousands of men to clean streets and ordered police stations opened at night for men seeking a place to sleep. Chicago's Commercial and Financial Chronicle reported, "Never before has there been such a sudden and striking cessation of industrial activity." The white city had drawn men and protected them. The black city now welcomed them back, on the eve of winter, with filth, starvation, and violence. Holmes, too, sensed it was time to leave Chicago. The pressure from creditors and families was growing too great. First, he set fire to the top floor of his castle. The blaze did minimal damage, but he filed a claim for $6,000 on a policy acquired by his fictional alter ego, Hiram S. Campbell. An investigator for one of the insurance companies, F.G. Cowie, became suspicious and decided to begin a detailed investigation. Though he found no concrete evidence of arson, Cowie believed Holmes or an accomplice had started the fire. He advised the insurers to pay the claim, but only to Hiram S. Campbell, and only if Campbell presented himself in person. Holmes could not claim the money himself, for by now Cowie knew him. Ordinarily, he simply would have recruited someone else to masquerade as Campbell and claim the money, but of late, he had become increasingly wary. The guardians of Minnie Williams had dispatched an attorney, William Capp, to look for Minnie and to protect the assets of her estate. Anna's guardian, the Reverend Dr. Black, had hired a private detective who had come to Holmes' building, and letters continued to arrive from the Segrands and Smythes and other parents. No one had yet accused Holmes of foul play, but the intensity of this new wave of inquiry was greater, more obliquely accusatory than anything he previously had experienced. Hiram S. Campbell never claimed the money. In the fall of 1893, Holmes set out for Fort Worth, Texas, to take better advantage of Minnie Williams' land. He had plans for the property. He would sell some of it, and on the rest build a three-story structure exactly like the one in Englewood. Meanwhile, he would use the land to secure loans and float notes. He expected to lead a very prosperous and satisfying life, at least until the time came to move on to the next city. He brought along his assistant, Benjamin Petizel, and his new fiancée, the small and pretty Miss Georgiana Yoke. Just before leaving Chicago, Holmes acquired a life insurance policy from Fidelity Mutual Life of Philadelphia to insure Petizel's life for $10,000. Throughout October, attendance at the fair rose sharply as more and more people realized the time left to see the White City was running short. Everyone hoped that attendance would continue rising and that the number of people drawn to the closing ceremony of October 30th would break the record set on Chicago Day. To attract visitors for the close, Frank Millett planned a day-long celebration with music, speeches, fireworks, and a landing by Columbus himself from the exposition's full-sized replicas of the Niña, Pinta, and Santa Maria built in Spain for the fair. Millett hired actors to play Columbus and his captains. The crew would consist of the men who had sailed the ships to Chicago. First, however, came Mayor Harrison's big day, American Cities Day, on Saturday, October 28th. 5,000 mayors and city councilmen had accepted Harrison's invitation to the fair, among them the mayors of San Francisco, New Orleans, and Philadelphia. Press accounts made no mention of the mayor of New York. Apparently, there was only so much crow that even a city the size of New York could be expected to digest. That morning, Harrison delighted reporters by announcing that, yes, the rumors about him and the very young Miss Annie Howard were true. And not only that, the two planned to marry on November 16th. The glory time came in the afternoon, when he rose to speak to the assembled mayors. Friends said he had never looked so handsome, so full of life. Prendergast could stand it no longer. His visit to the Corporation Council's office, by rights his office, had been humiliating. They had humored him, smirked. Yet Harrison had promised him the job. What did he have to do to get the mayor's attention? All his postcards had achieved nothing. No one wrote to him. No one took him seriously. At 2 o'clock on American Cities Day, Prendergast left his mother's house and walked to a shoe dealer on Milwaukee Avenue. He paid the dealer $4 for a used 6-chamber revolver. He knew that revolvers of this particular model had a penchant for accidental discharge when bumped or dropped, so he loaded it with only 5 cartridges and kept the empty chamber under the hammer. Later, much would be made of this precaution. It was nearly dark when Harrison left Jackson Park and drove north through the cold, smoky evening toward his mansion on Ashland Avenue. Temperatures had fallen sharply over the week, down to the 30s at night, and the sky seemed perpetually overcast. Harrison reached his home by 7 o'clock. He tinkered with a first-floor window, then sat down to supper with 2 of his children, Sophie and Preston. He had other children, but they were grown and gone. In the midst of supper, at approximately 7:30, someone rang the bell at the front door. Mary Hansen, the parlor maid, answered and found a gaunt young man with a smooth-shaven face and close-cut black hair. He looked ill. He asked to see the mayor. By itself, there was nothing peculiar about the request. Evening visits by strangers were a regular occurrence at the Ashland House, for Harrison prided himself on being available to any citizen of Chicago, regardless of social stature. Tonight's visitor seemed seedier than most, however, and behaved oddly. Nonetheless, Mary Hansen told him to come back in 30 minutes. The day had been an exciting one for the mayor, but also exhausting. He fell asleep at the table. Shortly before 8 o'clock, his son left the dining room to go up to his room and dress for an engagement in the city later that night. Sophie also went upstairs to write a letter. The house was cozy and well lit. Mary Hansen and the other servants gathered in the kitchen for their own supper. At precisely 8 o'clock, the front bell rang again, and again Hansen answered it. The same young man stood at the threshold. Hansen asked him to wait in the hall and went to get the mayor. "It must have been about 8 o'clock when I heard a noise," Harrison's son Preston said. "I was startled. It sounded like a picture falling." Sophie heard it too, and heard her father cry out. "I thought nothing of it," she said, "because I thought it was some screens falling on the floor near the back hall. Father's voice I took to be a yawn. He had a way of yawning very loud." Preston left his room and saw smoke drifting up from the entry hall. As he came down the steps, he heard 2 more reports. "The last shot was clear and penetrating," he said. "I knew it to be a revolver shot. It sounded like a manhole explosion." He ran to the hall and found Harrison lying on his back, surrounded by servants, the air silvered with gun smoke. There was very little blood. Preston shouted, "Father is not hurt, is he?" The mayor himself answered, "Yes," he said, "I am shot. I will die." 3 more shots rang from the street. The coachman had fired his own revolver once in the air to alert police, once at Prendergast, and Prendergast had returned the shot. The commotion brought a neighbor, William J. Chalmers, who folded his coat under Harrison's head. Harrison told him he had been shot over the heart, but Chalmers did not believe it. There was too little blood. They argued. Chalmers had told Harrison he had not been shot over the heart. Harrison snapped, "I tell you I am. This is death." A few moments later, his heart stopped. "He died angry," Chalmers said, "because I didn't believe him. Even in death, he is emphatic and imperious." Prendergast walked to the nearby Des Plaines Street police station and calmly told Desk Sergeant O.Z. Barber, "Lock me up. I am the man who shot the mayor." The sergeant was incredulous, until Prendergast gave him the revolver, which smelled strongly of blown powder. Barbara found that its cylinder contained 4 spent cartridges and a single live one. The 6th chamber was empty. Barbara asked Prendergast why he had shot the mayor. "Because he betrayed my confidence. I supported him through his campaign, and he promised to appoint me Corporation Counsel. He didn't live up to his word." The Exposition Company canceled the closing ceremony. It became instead a memorial assembly in the Fair's Festival Hall. As the audience entered, an organist played Chopin's funeral march on the hall's giant pipe organ. The hall was so cold, the presiding officer announced that men could keep their hats on. Reverend Dr. J.H. Barrows read a blessing and a benediction, and then, at the request of exposition officials, read a speech that Higginbotham had prepared for the originally planned ceremony. The remarks still seemed appropriate, especially one passage. "We are turning our backs upon the fairest dream of civilization and are about to consign it to the dust," Barrows read. "It is like the death of a dear friend." The audience exited slowly into the cold gray afternoon. At exactly 4:45, sunset, the warship Michigan fired one of its cannon and continued to fire 20 times more as 1,000 men quietly took up positions at each of the exposition's flags. With the last boom of the Michigan's gun, the great flag at the administration building fell to the ground. Simultaneously, the 1,000 other flags also fell, as masked trumpeters and bassoonists in the Court of Honor played the Star-Spangled Banner and America. 200,000 visitors, many in tears, joined in. The fair was over. The exposition proved unable to hold the Black City at bay for very long. With its formal closure, thousands more workers joined the swelling army of the unemployed, and homeless men took up residence among the great abandoned palaces of the fair. "What a spectacle," wrote Ray Stannard Baker in his American Chronicle. "What a human downfall after the magnificence and prodigality of the World's Fair, which had so recently closed its doors. Heights of splendor, pride, exaltation in one month, depths of wretchedness, suffering, hunger, cold in the next." "It is desolation," wrote Teresa Dean, the columnist, about a visit she made to Jackson Park on January 2, 1894. "You wish you had not come. If there were not so many around, you would reach out your arms with the prayer on your lips for it all to come back to you. It seems cruel, cruel, to give us such a vision, to let us dream and drift through heaven for 6 months, and then to take it out of our lives." 6 days after her visit, the first fires occurred and destroyed several structures. The following morning, Big Mary, chipped and soiled, stood over a landscape of twisted and blackened steel. The winter became a crucible for American labor. To workers, Eugene Debs and Samuel Gompers came increasingly to seem like saviors, Chicago's merchant princes like devils. On May 11, 1894, 2,000 Pullman workers went on strike with the support of Debs' American Railway Union. Other strikes broke out around the country, and Debs began planning a nationwide general strike to begin in July. President Cleveland ordered federal troops to Chicago and placed them under the command of General Nelson A. Miles, previously the Grand Marshal of the Exposition. Strikers blocked trains and burned rail cars. On July 5, 1894, arsonists set fire to the 7 greatest palaces of the Exposition. In the Loop, men and women gathered on rooftops and in the highest offices of the Rookery, the Masonic Temple, the Temperance Tower, and every other high place to watch the distant conflagration. Flames rose 100 feet into the night sky and cast their gleam far out onto the lake. "There was no regret," observed the Chicago Tribune, "rather a feeling of pleasure that the elements, and not the wrecker, should wipe out the spectacle of the Columbian season." 1894 to 1895. Detective Frank Geyer was a man with a pleasant, earnest face, a large walrus mustache, and a new gravity in his gaze and demeanor. He was one of Philadelphia's top detectives and had been a member of the force for 20 years, during which time he had investigated some 200 killings. He knew murder and its unchanging templates. Husbands killed wives, wives killed husbands, The poor killed one another, always for the usual motives of money, jealousy, passion, and love. Rarely did a murder involve the mysterious elements of dime novels or the stories of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. From the start, however, Geyer's current assignment had veered from the ordinary. One unusual aspect was that the suspect already was in custody, arrested November 17, 1894, for insurance fraud. The suspect was a physician whose given name was Mudgett, but who was known more commonly by the alias H.H. Holmes. He once had lived in Chicago, where he and an associate, Benjamin Petiesel, had run a hotel during the World's Columbian Exposition of 1893. They had moved next to Fort Worth, Texas, then to St. Louis, and on to Philadelphia, committing frauds along the way. In Philadelphia, Holmes had swindled the Fidelity Mutual Life Association of nearly $10,000 by apparently faking the death of a policyholder, Ben Petiesel. Holmes had bought the insurance 2 years earlier in 1893 from Fidelity's Chicago office just before the close of the exposition. As evidence of fraud accumulated, Fidelity had hired the Pinkerton National Detective Agency, the Eye That Never Sleeps, to search for Holmes. The agency's operatives picked up his trail in Burlington, Vermont, and followed him to Boston, where they arranged to have him arrested by police. Holmes confessed to the fraud and agreed to be extradited to Philadelphia for trial. At that point, the case appeared to be closed. But now it was June 1895. 7 months had passed since Holmes' arrest, and it was becoming increasingly apparent that he had not faked the death of Ben Petiesel. He had killed him, and then arranged the scene to make the death seem accidental. Now three of Petiesel's five children, Alice, Nellie, and Howard, were missing. Last seen in Holmes' company. Geyer's assignment was to find the children. Geyer interviewed Holmes in his cell, but learned nothing new. Holmes insisted that when he had last seen the children, they were alive and traveling with an accomplice named Minnie Williams, en route to the place where their father was hiding out. Holmes claimed to have secured a cadaver that resembled Petiesel and to have placed it on the second floor of a house rented especially for the fraud. By coincidence, or out of some malignant expression of humor, the house was located right behind the city morgue, a few blocks north of City Hall. Holmes admitted arranging the cadaver to suggest that Petiesel had died in an accidental explosion. He poured a solvent on the cadaver's upper body and set it on fire, then positioned the body on the floor in direct sunlight. By the time the body was discovered, its features had been distorted well beyond recognition. Holmes volunteered to assist the coroner in making an identification. At the morgue, he not only helped locate a distinctive wart on the dead man's neck, he pulled out his own lancet and removed the wart himself, then matter-of-factly handed it to the coroner. The coroner had wanted a member of the Petiesel family also to be present at the identification. Petiesel's wife, Carrie, was ill and could not come. Instead, she sent her second eldest daughter, Alice, 15 years old. The coroner's men draped the body so as to allow Alice to see only Petiesel's teeth. She seemed confident that the corpse was her father. Fidelity paid the death benefit. Next, Holmes traveled to St. Louis, where the Petiesel family now lived. Still in possession of Alice, he persuaded Carrie to let him pick up two more of her children, explaining that their father, in hiding, was desperate to see them. He took Nellie, 11, and Howard, 8, and embarked with all three children on a strange, sad journey. Geyer knew from Alice's letters that initially she found the trip to be something of an adventure. In a letter to her mother dated September 20, 1894, Alice wrote, "I wish you could see what I have seen." In the same letter, she expressed her distaste for Holmes' treacly manner. "I don't like him to call me babe and child and dear and all such trash." Since leaving St. Louis, Alice had heard nothing from home and feared her mother's illness might have gotten much worse. "Have you gotten four letters from me besides this?" Alice wrote. "Are you sick in bed yet, or are you up? I wish that I could hear from you." One of the few things that Detective Geyer knew with certainty was that neither of these letters ever reached Carrie Petiesel. Alice and Nellie had written to their mother repeatedly while in Holmes' custody, and had given the letters to Holmes with the expectation that he would mail them. He He never did. Shortly after his arrest, police discovered a tin box marked property of H.H. Holmes, containing various documents and a dozen letters from the girls. He had stored them in the box, as if they were seashells collected from a beach. Now, Mrs. Petizel was nearly crushed with anxiety and grief, despite Holmes' latest assurances that Alice, Nellie, and Howard were in London, England, under the able care of Minnie Williams. A search by Scotland Yard had found no trace of any of them. Geyer had little hope that his own search would fare any better. Geyer set out on the evening of June 26, 1895, a hot night in a hot summer. As his train sped west through the heat-steamed hollows of Pennsylvania and Ohio, he reread his copies of the children's letters to look for anything he might have missed that could help direct his search. The letters not only provided irrefutable proof that the children had been with Holmes, but contained enough geographic references to allow Geyer to plot the broad contours of the route he and the children had followed. Their first stop appeared to have been Cincinnati. Geyer reached Cincinnati at 7:30 p.m. on Thursday, June 27th. He checked into the Palace Hotel. The next morning, he went to police headquarters to brief the city's police superintendent on his mission. The superintendent assigned a detective to assist him, Detective John Schnooks, an old friend of Geyer's. The detectives trudged from one hotel to the next. The day got hotter and hotter. The detectives were courteous and never showed impatience, despite having to make the same introductions and tell the same story over and over again. On Central Avenue, they came to a small, inexpensive hotel, the Atlantic House. As they had done at all the other hotels, they asked the clerk if they could see his registration book. They turned first to Friday, September 28, 1894, the day that Holmes, while already in possession of Alice, had picked up Nellie and Howard from their St. Louis home. Geyer guessed Holmes and the children had reached Cincinnati later that same Friday. Geyer ran his finger down the page for September 28th and stopped at an entry for Alex E. Cook, a guest who, according to the register, was traveling with three children. The entry jogged Geyer's memory. Holmes had used the name before to rent a house in Burlington, Vermont. Also, Geyer by now had seen a lot of Holmes' handwriting. The writing in the ledger looked familiar. The Cook party stayed only one night, the register showed, but Geyer knew from the girls' letters that they had remained in Cincinnati at least two more days. It seemed odd that Holmes would go to the trouble of moving to a second hotel, but Geyer knew from experience that making assumptions about the behavior of criminals was always a dangerous thing. He and Schnooks thanked the clerk for his kind attention, then set out to canvass more hotels. The sun was high, the streets steamed. Cicadas scratched off messages from every tree. At 6th and Vine, the detectives came to a hotel called the Bristol and discovered that on Saturday, September 29, 1894, a party identified as A.E. Cook had checked in with three children. When the clerk saw Geyer's photographs, he confirmed that the guests were Holmes, Alice, Nellie, and Howard. They checked out the next morning, Sunday, September 30th. The date fit the likely chronology of events. Geyer knew from the children's letters that on that Sunday morning, they had left Cincinnati and by evening had arrived in Indianapolis. Geyer was not yet ready to leave Cincinnati, however. Now he played a hunch. The Pinkertons had found that Holmes sometimes rented houses in the cities through which he traveled, as he had done in Burlington. Geyer and Schnooks turned their attention to Cincinnati's real estate agents. Their search eventually took them to the realty office of J.C. Thomas on East 3rd Street. Something about Holmes must have caused people to take notice, because both Thomas and his clerk remembered him. Holmes had rented a house at 305 Poplar Street under the name A.C. Hayes and had made a substantial advance payment. The date of the agreement, Thomas said, was September 28, 1894, the Friday when Holmes and the children had arrived in Cincinnati. Holmes held the house only 2 days. Thomas could offer no further details, but referred the detectives to a woman named Henrietta Hill who lived next door to the house. Geyer and Schnooks immediately set out from Miss Hill's residence and found her to be an acute observer and a willing gossip. "There is really very little to tell," she said, then told them a lot. She had first noticed the new tenant on Saturday, September 29th, when a furniture wagon stopped in front of the rental house. A man and a boy descended. What most caught Miss Hill's attention was the fact that the furniture wagon was empty, save for an iron stove that seemed much too large for a private residence. Miss Hill found the stove sufficiently strange that she mentioned it to her neighbors. The next morning, Holmes came to her front door and told her he was not going to stay in the house after all. If she wanted the stove, he said, she could have it. Detective Geyer theorized that Holmes must have sensed an excess of neighborly scrutiny and changed his plans. But what were those plans? At the time, Geyer wrote, "I was not able to appreciate the intense significance of the renting of the Poplar Street house and the delivery of a stove of such immense size. He was certain, however, that he had taken firm hold of the end of the string that would lead to the children." Based on the girl's letters, Geyer's next stop was obvious. He thanked Detective Schnooks for his companionship and caught a train to Indianapolis. It was even hotter in Indianapolis. Leaves hung in the stillness like hands of the newly dead. Early Sunday morning, Geyer went to the police station and picked up a new local partner, Detective David Richards. One part of the trail was easy to find. In Nellie Petizel's letter from Indianapolis, she'd written, "We are at the English H." Detective Richards knew the place, the Hotel English. In the hotel's register, Geyer found an entry on September 30th for three Canning children. Canning, he knew, was Carrie Petizel's maiden name. Nothing was simple, however. According to the register, the Canning children had checked out the next day, Monday, October 1st. Yet Geyer knew, again from their letters, that the children had remained in Indianapolis for at least another week. Holmes seemed to be repeating the pattern he had established in Cincinnati. Geyer began the same methodical canvass he had conducted in Cincinnati. He and Detective Richards checked hotel after hotel, but found no further reference to the children. They did, however, find something else. At a hotel called the Circle Park, they discovered an entry for Mrs. Georgia Howard. Howard was one of Holmes' more common aliases, Geyer now knew. He believed this woman could be Holmes' latest wife, Georgiana Yoke. The register showed that Mrs. Howard had checked in on Sunday, September 30th, 1894, and stayed four nights. Geyer showed his photographs to the hotel's proprietor, a Mrs. Rodius, who recognized Holmes and Yoke, but not the children. Mrs. Rodius and Yoke had become friends. In one conversation, Yoke told her that her husband was a very wealthy man and that he owned real estate and cattle ranches in Texas, also had considerable real estate in Berlin, Germany, where they intended to go as soon as her husband could get his business affairs into shape to leave. The timing of all these hotel stays was perplexing. As best Geyer could tell, on that one Sunday, September 30th, Holmes somehow had managed to maneuver the three children and his own wife into different hotels in the same city without revealing their existence to each other. But where had the children gone next? Geyer and Richards examined the registers of every hotel and boarding house in Indianapolis, but found no further trace of the children. The Indianapolis leg of Geyer's search seemed to have reached a dead end when Richards remembered that a hotel called the Circle House had been opened during the fall of 1894, but had since closed. He and Geyer checked with other hotels to find out who had run the Circle House and learned from its former clerk that the registration records were in the possession of a downtown attorney. The records had been poorly kept, but among the guests who had arrived on Monday, October 1st, Geyer found a familiar entry. Three Canning children. The register showed the children were from Galva, Illinois, the town where Mrs. Petizel had grown up. Geyer now felt a pressing need to talk to the hotel's past manager and found him running a saloon in West Indianapolis. His name was Herman Akelo. Geyer explained his mission and immediately showed Akelo his photographs of Holmes and the Petizel children. Akelo was silent for a moment. "Yes," he said. He was sure of it. The man in the photograph had come to his hotel. It was the children, however, that he remembered most clearly, and now he told the detectives why. Each day, Akelo would send his eldest son up to the children's room to call them for their meals. Often the boy reported back that the children were crying, evidently heartbroken and homesick to see their mother or hear from her, Geyer wrote. Holmes said that Howard was a very bad boy, Akelo recalled, and that he was trying to place him in some institution, or bind him out to some farmer, as he wanted to get rid of the responsibility of looking after him. Geyer still nurtured a small hope that the children really were alive, as Holmes insisted. Despite his 20 years on the police force, Geyer found it difficult to believe that anyone could kill 3 children for absolutely no reason. With each new step in the search, however, the story became only more sinister. The insurance fraud a portal to something infinitely more grotesque. Geyer caught a train to Detroit, the city where Alice had written the last of the letters in the tin box. Geyer was getting a feel for his quarry. There was nothing rational about Holmes, but his behavior seemed to follow a pattern. Geyer knew what to look for in Detroit, and with the assistance of another police detective, once again began a patient canvas of hotels and boarding houses. Though he told his story and showed his photographs 100 times, he never tired and was always patient and polite. These were his strengths. His weakness was his belief that evil had boundaries. Once again, he picked up the children's trail and the parallel registrations of Holmes and Yoke, but now he discovered something even stranger, that during this same period, Carrie Petizel and her 2 other children, Desi and Baby Wharton, had also checked into a Detroit hotel, this one called Geiss's Hotel. Geyer realized to his astonishment that Holmes now was moving 3 different parties of travelers from place to place, shoving them across the landscape as if they were toys. And he discovered something else. In walking from lodging to lodging, he saw not only that Holmes had kept Carrie away from Alice, Nellie, and Howard, he had placed them in establishments only 3 blocks apart. Suddenly, the true implication of what Holmes had done became clear to him. He reread Alice's final letter. She had written it to her grandparents on Sunday, October 14th, the same day in which her mother, along with Desi and the baby, had checked into Geiss's hotel. This was the saddest letter of them all. Alice and Nellie both had colds, and the weather had turned wintry. "Tell Mama that I have to have a coat. I nearly freeze in that thin jacket," Alice wrote. "I wish I could see you all. I am getting so homesick that I don't know what to do. I suppose Wharton walks by this time, don't he? I would like to have him here. He would pass away the time a good deal." Geyer was appalled. So when this poor child Alice was writing to her grandparents in Galva, Illinois, complaining of the cold, sending a message to her mother, asking for heavier and more comfortable clothing, wishing for little Wharton, the baby who would help them pass away the time, while this wearied, lonely, homesick child was writing this letter, her mother and her sister and the much-wished-for Wharton were within 10 minutes' walk of her and continued there for the next 5 days. It was a game for Holmes, Geyer realized. He possessed them all and reveled in his possession. One additional phrase of Alice's letter kept running through Geyer's brain. "Howard," she had written, "is not with us now." Holmes sat at his cell at Moyamensing Prison, a large, turreted and crenellated building at 10th and Reed Streets in South Philadelphia. He did not seem terribly troubled by his incarceration, although he complained of its injustice. "The great humiliation of feeling that I am a prisoner is killing me far more than any other discomforts I have to endure," he wrote, though in fact he felt no humiliation whatsoever. If he felt anything, it was a smug satisfaction that so far no one had been able to produce any concrete evidence that he had killed Ben Petizel or the missing children. Holmes became a model prisoner, became in fact the model of a model prisoner. He made a game of using his charm to gain concessions from his keepers. He was allowed to wear his own clothes and to keep my watch and other small belongings. He discovered also that he could pay to have food, newspapers, and magazines brought in from outside. He read of his increasing national notoriety. He read also that Frank Geyer, a Philadelphia police detective who had interviewed him in June, was now in the Middle West searching for Petizel's children. The search delighted Holmes. It satisfied his profound need for attention and gave him a sense of power over the detective. He knew that Geyer's search would be in vain. Holmes' cell was furnished with a bed, a stool, and a writing table upon which he composed his memoir. He had begun it, he said, the preceding winter, to be exact, on December 3, 1894. He began the memoir as if it were a fable. "Come with me, if you will, to a tiny, quiet New England village, nestling among the picturesquely rugged hills of New Hampshire. Here in the year 1861, I, Herman W. Mudgett, the author of these pages, was born. That the first years of my life were different from those of any other ordinary country-bred boy, I have no reason to think." The dates and places were correct. His description of his boyhood as a typical country idol was most certainly a fabrication. On Sunday, July 7, 1895, Detective Geyer took his search to Toronto, where the city's police department assigned Detective Alf Cuddy to assist him. Together, Geyer and Cuddy scoured the hotels and boarding houses of Toronto, and after days of searching found that here, too, Holmes had been moving three parties of travelers simultaneously. On Monday morning, July 15th, Geyer awoke, facing the prospect of yet another day of mind-numbing routine. But when he arrived at headquarters, he found Detective Cuddy in an unusually good mood. A tip had come in that Cuddy found promising. A resident named Thomas Reeves had read Holmes' description in a newspaper article and thought it sounded like a man who in October 1894 had rented the house next door to his at 16 St. Vincent Street. Geyer was leery. The intensive press coverage of his mission and his arrival in Toronto had generated thousands of tips, all useless. Cuddy agreed that the latest tip was probably another wild goose chase, but at least it offered a change of pace. By now, Geyer was a national fascination, America's Sherlock Holmes. Reports of his travels appeared in newspapers throughout the nation. In this day, the possibility that a man had killed three young children was still considered a horror well beyond the norm. There was something about Detective Geyer's lone search through the sweltering heat of that summer that captured everyone's imagination. He had become the living representation of how men like to think of themselves, one man doing an awful duty and doing it well against the odds. Millions of people woke each morning, hoping to read in their newspapers that this staunch detective at last had found the missing children. The detectives found Thomas Reeves to be a charming Scotsman of considerable age who welcomed them with enthusiasm. Reeves explained why the renter next door had caught his attention. For one thing, he arrived with little furniture, a mattress, an old bed, and an unusually large trunk. One afternoon, the tenant came to Reeves' house to borrow a shovel, explaining that he wanted to dig a hole in the cellar for the storage of potatoes. He returned the shovel the next morning, and the following day removed the trunk from the house. Reeves never saw him again. Detective Geyer, now galvanized, told Reeves to meet him in front of the neighboring house in exactly 1 hour. Then he and Cuddy sped to the home of the realtor who had arranged the rental. With little preamble, Geyer showed her a photograph of Holmes. She recognized him instantly. He had been very handsome, with amazing blue eyes. "This seemed too good to be true," Geyer wrote. He and Cuddy offered quick thanks and rushed back to St. Vincent Street. Reeves was waiting outside. Now Geyer asked to borrow a shovel, and Reeves returned with the same one he had loaned the tenant. The house was charming, with a steeply pitched central gable and scallop trim like the gingerbread house in a fairy tale, except this house did not sit alone in a deep wood, but in the heart of Toronto. The current tenant, a Mrs. J. Armbrust, answered the door. Reeves introduced the detectives. Mrs. Armbrust led them inside. Geyer asked to see the cellar. Mrs. Armbrust led the detectives into the kitchen, where she lifted a sheet of oilcloth from the floor. A square trap door lay underneath. As the detectives opened it, the scent of moist earth drifted upward into the kitchen. The cellar was shallow but very dark. Mrs. Armbrust brought lamps. Geyer and Cuddy descended a steep set of steps, more ladder than stairway, into a small chamber about 10 feet long by 10 feet wide and only 4 feet high. The lamps shed a shifting orange light that exaggerated the detective's shadows. Hunched over, wary of the overhead beams, Geyer and Cuddy tested the ground with a spade. In the southwest corner, Geyer found a soft spot. The spade entered with disconcerting ease. "Only a slight hole had been made," Geyer said. when the gases burst forth and the stench was frightful. At 3 feet, they uncovered human bone. They summoned an undertaker named B.D. Humphrey to help recover the remains. Geyer and Cuddy gingerly climbed back down into the cellar. Humphrey leapt down. The stench now suffused the entire house. Mrs. Armbrust looked stricken. Then the coffins arrived. The undertaker's men put them in the kitchen. The children had been buried nude. Alice lay on her side, her head at the west end of the grave. Nellie lay face down, partially covering Alice. Her rich black hair, nicely plaited, lay along her back as neatly as if she had just combed it. The men spread a sheet on the cellar floor. They began with Nellie. "We lifted her as gently as possible," Geyer said. "But owing to the decomposed state of the body, the weight of her plaited hair hanging down her back pulled the scalp from her head." They discovered something else. Nellie's feet had been amputated. During the search of the residence that followed, police found no trace of them. At first, this seemed a mystery, until Geyer recalled that Nellie was club-footed. Holmes had disposed of her feet to remove this distinctive clue to her identity. Mrs. Petizel learned of the discovery of her girls by reading a morning newspaper. She had been visiting friends back in Chicago, and thus Geyer had been unable to telegraph the news to her directly. She caught a train to Toronto. Geyer met her at the station and took her to his hotel, the Rossin House. She was exhausted and sad and seemed perpetually near fainting. Geyer roused her with smelling salts. Geyer and Cuddy came for her the next afternoon to bring her to the morgue. Geyer wrote, "I told her that it would be absolutely impossible for her to see anything but Alice's teeth and hair, and only the hair belonging to Nellie. This had a paralyzing effect upon her, and she almost fainted." Her situation had captured the city's heart. The coroner's men did what they could to make the viewings as endurable as possible. They cleaned the flesh from Alice's skull and carefully polished her teeth, then covered her body with canvas. They laid paper over her face and cut a hole in the paper to expose only her teeth, just as the Philadelphia coroner had done for her father. They washed Nellie's hair and laid it carefully on the canvas that covered Alice's body. Cuddy and Geyer took positions on opposite sides of Mrs. Petizel and led her into the dead house. She recognized Alice's teeth immediately. She turned to Geyer. "Where is Nellie?" And only then noticed Nellie's long black hair. The coroner, unable to find any marks of violence, theorized that Holmes had locked the girls in the big trunk, then filled it with gas from a lamp valve. Indeed, when police found the trunk, they discovered a hole drilled through one side, covered with a makeshift patch. "Nothing could be more surprising," Geyer wrote, "than the apparent ease with which Holmes murdered the two little girls in the very center of the city of Toronto, without arousing the least suspicion of a single person there." For Geyer, finding the girls was one of the most satisfactory events of my life. But his satisfaction was tempered by the fact that Howard remained missing. Mrs. Petizel refused to believe Howard was dead. She clung fondly to the hope that he would ultimately be found alive. In Philadelphia, on the morning of Tuesday, July 16, 1895, the day Geyer's Toronto discoveries were reported in the nation's newspapers, the district attorney's office telephoned an urgent message to the warden at Moyamensing Prison, instructing him to keep all the morning's newspapers away from Holmes. The order came from Assistant District Attorney Thomas W. Barlow. He wanted to surprise Holmes with the news, hoping it would rattle him so thoroughly that he would confess. Barlow's order came too late. The guard sent to intercept the morning papers found Holmes sitting at his table, reading the news as calmly as if reading about the weather. In his memoir, Holmes contended that the news did shock him. His newspaper came that morning at 8:30, as it always did. He wrote, "And I had hardly opened it before I saw in large headlines the announcement of the finding of the children in Toronto. For the moment, it seemed so impossible that I was inclined to think it one of the frequent newspaper excitements that had attended the earlier part of the case. But suddenly," he wrote, "he realized what must have happened. Minnie Williams killed them, or had ordered them killed. Holmes knew she had an unsavory associate named Hatch. He guessed that Williams had suggested the killings, and Hatch had carried them out. It was all too horrible to comprehend. Holmes was driven north on Broad Street to City Hall, through air as sticky as taffy. In the DA's office, he was questioned by Barlow. The Philadelphia Public Ledger reported that Holmes' genius for explanation had deserted him. For 2 hours, he sat under a shower of questions and refused to talk. He was not cowed by any means, but he would give absolutely no satisfaction. Holmes was driven back to Moyamensing. He began earnestly trying to find a publisher for his memoir, hoping to get it quickly into print to help turn public opinion to his favor. If he could not exert his great powers of persuasion directly, he could at least attempt to do so indirectly in print. He struck a deal with a journalist named John King to arrange publication and market the book. It was a strange moment for Geyer. He had examined every lead, checked every hotel, visited every boarding house and real estate agent, and yet now he had to begin his search anew. Where? What path was left? His instincts kept telling him that Holmes had killed Howard in Indianapolis. He returned there on July 24th and again received the assistance of Detective David Richards. He and Richards trudged through the heat from office to office, house to house, and found nothing. Days came and passed, but I continued to be as much in the dark as ever, and it began to look as though the bold but clever criminal had outwitted the detectives, and that the disappearance of Howard Petitzel would pass into history as an unsolved mystery. Meanwhile, the mystery of Holmes himself grew deeper and darker. Geyer's discovery of the girls prompted Chicago police to enter Holmes' building in Englewood. Each day they delved more deeply into the secrets of the castle, and each day turned up additional evidence that Holmes was something far worse than even Geyer's macabre discoveries indicated. There was speculation that during the World's Fair, he might have killed dozens of people, most of them young women. One estimate, certainly an exaggeration, put the toll at 200. Chicago detectives began their exploration of the castle on the night of Friday, July 19th. First, they made a broad survey of the building. The third floor contained small hotel rooms. The second floor had 35 rooms that were harder to classify. Some were ordinary bedrooms. Others had no windows and were fitted with doors that made the rooms airtight. One room contained a walk-in vault with iron walls. Police found a gas jet with no apparent function, other than to admit gas into the vault. Its cutoff valve was located in Holmes' personal apartment. In Holmes' office, they found a bank book belonging to a woman named Lucy Burbank. It listed a balance of $23,000. The woman could not be located. The eeriest phase of the investigation began when the police, holding their flickering lanterns high, entered the hotel basement. A cavern of brick and timber measuring 50 by 165 feet. The discoveries came quickly. A vat of acid, with 8 ribs and part of a skull settled at the bottom. Mounds of quicklime. A large kiln. A dissection table stained with what seemed to be blood. They found surgical tools and charred high-heeled shoes. And more bones. Articles of clothing emerged from walls and from pits of ash and quicklime, including a girl's dress and blood-stained overalls. Human hair clotted a stovepipe. The searchers unearthed 2 buried vaults of quicklime and human remains. They theorized the remains might be the last traces of 2 Texas women, Minnie and Anna Williams, whom Chicago police only recently learned were missing. The next day, the police discovered another hidden chamber, this one at the cellar's southwest corner. They were led to it by a man named Charles Chappelle, alleged to have helped Holmes reduce corpses to bone. He was very cooperative, and soon the police recovered 3 fully articulated skeletons from their owners. A 4th was expected from Chicago's Hahnemann Medical College. One of the most striking discoveries came on the second floor in the walk-in vault. The inside of the door showed the unmistakable imprint of a woman's bare foot. Police theorized that the print had been made by a woman suffocating within. Her name, they believed, was Emmeline Segrand. Detectives theorized that Holmes, known to have an avid interest in chemistry, first poured a sheen of acid onto the floor to hasten by chemical reaction the consumption of oxygen in the vault. The theory held that Emmeline had stepped in the acid, then placed her feet against the door, thus literally etching the print into the enamel. Chicago police telegraphed District Attorney George Graham that their search of the Holmes building had uncovered the skeleton of a child. Graham ordered Geyer to Chicago to see if the remains might be those of Howard Petitzel. Geyer found the city transfixed by the revelations emerging from the castle. He met with the lead police inspector and learned that a physician who had examined the child's skeleton had ruled it to be that of a little girl. The inspector thought he knew the girl's identity and mentioned a name, Pearl Connor. The name meant nothing to Geyer. Geyer telegraphed his disappointment to Graham, who ordered him back to Philadelphia for consultation and rest. On Wednesday evening, August 7th, with temperatures in the 90s and train cars like ovens, Geyer set out again, this time accompanied by Fidelity Mutual's top insurance investigator, Inspector W.E. Gary. Geyer was glad for the company. They went to Chicago, then to Indiana, where they stopped in Logansport in Peru, then to Montpelier Junction, Ohio, and Adrian, Michigan. They spent days searching the records of every hotel, boarding house, and real estate office they could find. All, Geyer said, to no purpose. Although Geyer's brief rest in Philadelphia had recharged his hopes, he now found them fast dwindling away. He still believed his original instinct was correct, that Howard was in Indianapolis or somewhere nearby. He went there next, his third visit of the summer. "I must confess I returned to Indianapolis in no cheerful frame of mind," Geyer wrote. He and Inspector Gary checked into Geyer's old hotel, the Spencer House. The failure to find Howard after so much effort was frustrating and puzzling. The mystery, Geyer wrote, seemed to be impenetrable. On Thursday, August 19th, Geyer learned that during the preceding night, Holmes Castle in Englewood, his own dark dreamland, had burned to the ground. Front page headlines in the Chicago Tribune shouted, "Holmes' Den Burned. Fire Demolishes the Place of Murder and Mystery." The fire department suspected arson. Police theorized that whoever set the fire had wanted to destroy the secret still embedded within. They arrested no one. Together, Detective Geyer and Inspector Gary investigated 900 leads. They expanded their search to include small towns outside the city. "By Monday," Geyer wrote in a report to Superintendent Linden in Philadelphia, "we will have searched every outlying town except Irvington, and another day will conclude that. After Irvington, I scarcely know where we shall go." They went to Irvington on Tuesday morning, August 27, 1895, aboard an electric trolley, a new kind of streetcar that drew its power through a wheeled conducting apparatus on the roof called a troller. Just before the trolley reached its final stop, Geyer spotted a sign for a real estate office. He and Gary resolved to begin their search there. The proprietor was a Mr. Brown who examined the picture of Holmes. After a long pause, he said, "I did not have the renting of the house, but I had the keys, and one day last fall this man came into my office and in a very abrupt way said, 'I want the keys for that house.'" Geyer and Gary stood very still. Brown continued, "I remember the man very well because I did not like his manner, and I felt that he should have had more respect for my gray hairs." The detectives looked at one another. Both sat down at the same time. "All the toil," Geyer said. "All the weary days and weeks of travel, toil and travel in the hottest months of the year, alternating between faith and hope and discouragement and despair, all were recompensed in that one moment when I saw the veil about to lift." At the inquest that followed, a young man named Elvett Moorman testified he had helped Holmes set up a large wood stove in the house. He recalled asking Holmes why he didn't install a gas stove instead. Holmes answered that he did not think gas was healthy for children. The owner of an Indianapolis repair shop testified that Holmes had come into his shop on October 3, 1894, with two cases of surgical instruments and asked to have them sharpened. Holmes picked them up 3 days later. Detective Geyer testified as to how, during his search of the house, he opened the base of a chimney flue that extended from roof to cellar. While sifting the accumulated ash through a fly screen, he found human teeth and a fragment of jaw. He also retrieved a large charred mass, which upon being cut, disclosed a portion of the stomach, liver, and spleen, baked quite hard. The organs had been packed too tightly into the chimney, and thus never had burned. And of course Mrs. Petizel was summoned. She identified Howard's overcoat and his scarf pin, and a crochet needle that belonged to Alice. Finally, the coroner showed her a toy that Geyer himself had found in the house. It consisted of a tin man mounted on a spinning top. She recognized it. How could she not? It was Howard's most important possession. Mrs. Petizel herself had put it in the child's trunk just before she sent them off with Holmes. His father had bought it for him at the Chicago World's Fair. On September 12, 1895, a Philadelphia grand jury voted to indict Holmes for the murder of Benjamin Petizel. Only two witnesses presented evidence, L.G. Faust, president of Fidelity Mutual Life, and Detective Frank Geyer. Holmes stuck to his claim that Minnie Williams and the mysterious Hatch had killed the children. Grand juries in Indianapolis and Toronto found this unconvincing. Indianapolis indicted Holmes for the murder of Howard Petizel, Toronto for the murders of Alice and Nellie. If Philadelphia failed to convict him, there would be two more chances. If the city succeeded, the other indictments would be moot, for given the nature of the Petizel murder, a conviction in Philadelphia would bring a death sentence. Holmes' memoir reached newsstands. In its final pages, he stated, "In conclusion, I wish to say that I am but a very ordinary man, even below average in physical strength and mental ability, and to have planned and executed the stupendous amount of wrongdoing that has been attributed to me would have been wholly beyond my power." The Chicago Times-Herald said of Holmes, "He is a prodigy of wickedness, a human demon, a being so unthinkable that no novelist would dare to invent such a character." The story, too, tends to illustrate the end of the century. The fair had a powerful and lasting impact on the nation's psyche, in ways both large and small. Walt Disney's father Elias helped build the White City. Walt's Magic Kingdom may well be a descendant. The fair prompted President Harrison to designate October 12th a national holiday, Columbus Day. Every carnival since 1893 has included a midway and a Ferris wheel, and every grocery store contains products born at the exposition. Even the Lincoln Monument in Washington can trace its heritage to the fair. Its greatest impact lay in how it changed the way Americans perceived their cities and their architects. It primed the whole of America, not just a few rich architectural patrons, to think of cities in a way they never had before. The fair taught men and women steeped only in the necessary to see that cities did not have to be dark, soiled, and unsafe bastions of the strictly pragmatic. They could also be beautiful. For Burnham, the fair had been an unqualified triumph. It allowed him to fulfill his pledge to his parents, to become the greatest architect in America, for certainly in his day he had become so. During the fair, an event occurred whose significance to Burnham was missed by all but his closest friends. Both Harvard and Yale granted him honorary master's degrees in recognition of his achievement in building the fair. The ceremonies occurred on the same day. He attended Harvard's. For him, the awards were a form of redemption. His past failure to gain admission to both universities, the denial of his right beginning, had haunted him throughout his life. In 1901, Burnham built the Fuller Building at the triangular intersection of 23rd and Broadway in New York, but neighborhood residents found an uncanny resemblance to a common domestic tool and called it the Flatiron Building. Burnham and his firm went on to build scores of other structures, among them the Gimbel's Department Store in New York, Filene in Boston, and the Mount Wilson Observatory in Pasadena, California. Of the 27 buildings he and John Root built in Chicago's Loop, only three remain today. Among them, the Rookery, its top-floor library, much as it was during that magical meeting in February 1891, and the Reliance Building, beautifully transformed into the Hotel Burnham. Burnham's health began to decline early in the 20th century, when he was in his 50s. He developed colitis, and in 1909 learned he had diabetes. Both conditions forced him to adopt a more healthful diet. His diabetes damaged his circulatory system and fostered a foot infection that bedeviled him for the rest of his life. As the years passed, he revealed an interest in the supernatural. One night in San Francisco, in a bungalow he'd built at the fog-licked summit of Twin Peaks, his planning shanty, he told a friend, "If I were able to take the time, I believe that I could prove the continuation of life beyond the grave, reasoning from the necessity, philosophically speaking, of a belief in an absolute and universal power." He knew that his day was coming to an end. On July 4, 1909, as he stood with friends on the roof of the Reliance Building, looking out over the city he adored, he said, "You'll see it lovely. I never will, but it will be lovely." The roar in Olmsted's ears, the pain in his mouth, and the sleeplessness never eased, and soon an emptiness began to appear in his gaze. He became forgetful. On May 10, 1895, 2 weeks after his 73rd birthday, he wrote to his son John, "It has today, for the first time, become evident to me that my memory for recent occurrences is no longer to be trusted." During a period in September 1895 that he described as the bitterest week of my life, he confessed to his friend Charles Eliot his terror that his condition soon would require that he be placed in an asylum. His wife Mary and her sons realized there was little they could do for Olmsted. He had become unmanageable, his dementia profound. With deep sorrow and perhaps a good deal of relief, his son Rick lodged his father in the McLean Asylum in Waverly, Massachusetts. Olmsted's memory was not so destroyed that he did not realize he himself had designed McLean's grounds. This gave him no solace, for he saw immediately that the same phenomenon that had diminished nearly every one of his works, Central Park, Biltmore, the World's Fair, and so many others, had occurred yet again. "They didn't carry out my plan," he wrote. "Confound them." Olmsted died at 2 a.m. on August 28, 1903. His funeral was spare, family only. His wife, who had seen this great man disappear before her eyes, did not attend. Patrick Eugene Joseph Prendergast stood trial in December 1893. The prosecutor was a criminal attorney hired by the state for just this case. His name was Alfred S. Trude. Prendergast's lawyers tried to prove Prendergast was insane, but a jury of angry, grieving Chicagoans believed otherwise. One important piece of evidence tending to support the prosecution's case for sanity was the care Prendergast had taken to keep an empty chamber under the hammer of his revolver as he carried it in his pocket. At 2:28 p.m. on December 29th, after conferring for 1 hour and 3 minutes, the jury found him guilty. The judge sentenced him to death. Clarence Darrow entered the case, and in a novel maneuver, won for Prendergast a sanity inquest. This, too, failed, however, and Prendergast was executed. Darrow called him a poor, demented imbecile. In the fall of 1895, Holmes stood trial in Philadelphia for the murder of Benjamin F. Petizel. District Attorney George Graham brought 35 witnesses to Philadelphia from Cincinnati, Indianapolis, Irvington, Detroit, Toronto, Boston, Burlington, and Fort Worth, but they never were called. The judge ruled Graham could present only evidence tied directly to the Petizel murder, and thus eliminated from the historical record a rich seam of detail on the murders of Dr. Herman W. Mudgett, alias Holmes. There were sorrowful moments, especially when Mrs. Petizel took the stand. She wore a black dress, black hat, and black cape, and looked pale and sad. Often she paused in mid-sentence and rested her head on her hands. Graham asked her whether she had seen the children since the time in 1894 when Holmes took them away. She answered in a voice almost too soft to hear, "I saw them at Toronto in the morgue, side by side." So many handkerchiefs appeared among the men and women in the gallery that the courtroom looked as if it had just experienced a sudden snowfall. Graham called Holmes the most dangerous man in the world. The jury found him guilty. The judge sentenced him to death by hanging. Holmes' attorneys appealed the conviction and lost. As Holmes awaited execution, he prepared a long confession, his third, in which he admitted killing 27 people. As with two previous confessions, this one was a mixture of truth and falsehood. A few of the people he claimed to have murdered turned out to be alive. Exactly how many people he killed won't ever be known. At the very least, he killed 9. Julia and Pearl Connor, Emmeline Segrand, the Williams sisters, and Petizel and his children. No one doubted that he had killed many others. Detective Geyer believed that if the Pinkertons had not caught up with Holmes and arranged his arrest in Boston, he would have killed the rest of the Petizel family. That he fully intended to murder Mrs. Petizel and Desi and the baby Wharton is too evident for contradiction. Holmes, in his confession, also clearly lied, or at least was deeply deluded, when he wrote, "I am convinced that since my imprisonment, I have changed woefully and gruesomely from what I was formerly in feature and figure. My head and face are gradually assuming an elongated shape. I believe fully that I am growing to resemble the devil, that the similitude is almost completed." Afraid that someone would steal his own body after his execution, Holmes left instructions with his lawyers for how he was to be buried. He refused to allow an autopsy. His lawyers turned down an offer of $5,000 for his body. The Wistar Institute in Philadelphia wanted his brain. This request, too, the lawyers refused. Shortly before 10 a.m. on May 7, 1896, Holmes was escorted to the gallows at Moyamensing Prison. This was a difficult moment for his guards. They liked Holmes. They knew he was a killer, but he was a charming killer. The assistant superintendent, a man named Richardson, seemed nervous as he readied the noose. Holmes turned to him and smiled and said, "Take your time, old man." At 10:13, Richardson released the trap and hanged him. Using Holmes' instructions, workmen in the employ of undertaker John J. O'Rourke filled a coffin with cement, then placed Holmes' body inside and covered it with more cement. They hauled him south through the countryside to Holy Cross Cemetery, a Catholic burial ground in Delaware County, just south of Philadelphia. Strange things began to happen that made Holmes' claims about being the devil seem almost plausible. Detective Geyer became seriously ill. The warden of Moyamensing Prison committed suicide. The jury foreman was electrocuted in a freak accident. The priest who delivered Holmes' last rites was found dead on the grounds of his church of mysterious causes. The father of Emmeline Segrand was grotesquely burned in a boiler explosion, and a fire destroyed the office of District Attorney George Graham, leaving only a photograph of Holmes unscathed. No stone or tomb marks the grave of Herman Webster Mudgett, alias H.H. Holmes. His presence in Holy Cross Cemetery is something of a secret, recorded only in an ancient registry volume. At the graveside, there is only an open lawn in the midst of other old graves. Aboard the Olympic, Burnham waited for more news of Frank Millet and his ship. Just before sailing, he had written in longhand a 19-page letter to Millet urging him to attend the next meeting of the Lincoln Commission, which was then on the verge of deciding who would be awarded the commission to design the Lincoln Memorial. He addressed the envelope himself, certain that the United States Post Office would know exactly what to do. Honorable F.D. Millett, to arrive on steamship Titanic, New York. Burnham hoped that once the Olympic reached the site of the Titanic sinking, he would find Millett alive and hear him tell some outrageous story about the voyage. But during the night, the Olympic returned to its original course for England. Another vessel already had reached the Titanic. But there was a second reason for the Olympic's return to course. The builder of both ships, J. Bruce Ismay, himself a Titanic passenger, but one of the few male passengers to survive, was adamant that none of the other survivors see this duplicate of their own lost liner coming to their aid. The shock, he feared, would be too great and too humiliating to the White Star Line. The magnitude of the Titanic disaster quickly became apparent. Burnham lost his friend. The steward lost his son. William Stead also had been aboard and was drowned. That night, in the silence of Burnham's stateroom, as somewhere to the north the body of his last good friend drifted frozen in the strangely peaceful seas of the North Atlantic, Burnham opened his diary and began to write. He felt an acute loneliness. He wrote, "Frank Millett, whom I loved, was aboard her, thus cutting off my connection with one of the best fellows of the fair." Burnham lived only 47 more days. As he and his family traveled through Heidelberg, he slipped into a coma, the result apparently of a combined assault of diabetes, colitis, and his foot infection, all worsened by a bout of food poisoning. He died June 1, 1912. Margaret eventually moved to Pasadena, California, where she lived through time of war and epidemic and crushing financial depression, and then war again. She died December 23, 1945. Both are buried in Graceland Cemetery, on a tiny island in the cemetery's only pond. John Root lies nearby, as do the Palmers, Lewis Sullivan, Mayor Harrison, Marshall Field, Philip Armour, and so many others in vaults and tombs that vary from the simple to the grand. Potter and Bertha still dominate things, as if stature mattered even in death. They occupy a massive acropolis with 15 giant columns atop the only high ground, overlooking the pond. The others cluster around. On a crystalline fall day, you can almost hear the tinkle of fine crystal, the rustle of silk and wool, almost smell the expensive cigars. This is Tony Goldwyn. We hope you have enjoyed this production of The Devil in the White City by Eric Larson. This program was produced and directed by Robert Kessler, executive producer Sherry Huber, abridgment by Lynn Lauber, text copyright 2003 by Eric Larson, production copyright 2003, Random House, Inc., all rights reserved.